Members, we're going to call the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform to order. And we have a quorum present. The first motion of the business will be to approve the minutes for March 17th. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Backer moves the minutes of March 17th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Members, the first bill on our agenda is House File 1341. Representative Pearson, would you like to move your bill?
I would like to move House File 1341 for possible inclusion.
Yes, actually, we referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
That's what I meant to say, for referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee.
Excellent. And I understand we do have an amendment. Would you like to move your amendment?
I would like to move the A15-0257 amendment.
Okay, members, Representative Pearson moves the A15-0257 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Pearson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the Health and Human Services Committee. The Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division has been serving Minnesotans with hearing loss and their families for over 35 years. They are part of the Department of Human Services. The latest research says that 20% of the state has a hearing loss that is significant enough that it impedes the ability to communicate effectively. With aging boomers, there has never been a time when these services have been more important. Over the years, their budget has decreased significantly and compromised their ability to perform the tasks the state has asked it to do, including providing direct consumer assistance, training and consultation, community grants for mental health services, deaf-blind services, local news TV captioning in Greater Minnesota, assistive technology demonstration lab, and information and referral. Cuts to DHS have hit this division hard. 40% of their staff is deaf, deaf-blind, or hard of hearing, and the percentage of employees with disabilities at the rest of DHS is about 4%, plus or minus. Their cost of accommodations is much higher in their offices in Bemidji. The costs for accommodations are higher, and their offices in Bemidji and in Rochester have closed. Regional advisory committees that provide citizen input on services that need to be provided had to be put on hold. There are waiting lists for mental health services provided in ASL for children and adults. There are children in need of mental health services statewide, and there is a waiting list for services of children and adults who are deaf-blind. This bill would accomplish four important things. Increase grant money for direct services for deaf-blind children and adults. Increase mental health services. Increase division's ability to deliver pressing services and engage the community. And conduct a study on how to most effectively deliver their services statewide. Today I have a few testifiers that I would like to present if it so pleases the chair, and we can answer questions after the testifiers if that's okay.
Thank you, Representative Pearson. So why don't we go to your testifiers now, and then we'll take questions from the committee.
My first testifier is Alan Parness.
Okay. Mr. Barnes, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. First, it is Alan Parnes. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would like to thank Representative Pearson for introducing this proposed legislation. I am the chair of the Minnesotans Serving Deaf, Deaf-Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. I've been living in Minnesota for more than 25 years and worked closely with DHHSD, the division, during my entire career in a variety of capacities. As chair of the commission I've observed over the 12 years that I've been a member of the commission, our representation, our representation comes from 8 different regional advisory committees from around the state of Minnesota, where the state is divided at the eight regions. We meet 4 times a year. The regional representatives indicate to us in St. Paul what the issues are in their respective regions, whether they can avail themselves of services or not, and the struggles that they have. Over the years, we've watched the services and the capacity for services diminish significantly for people in greater Minnesota. And our concern, and we are very concerned about this, we're very happy to see that this is something that this bill is something, and the amendment is something that has come forward, and are hoping that it will carry. To be deaf is something that most people don't understand, because being deaf, as a deaf person, my disability is invisible, unless somebody who is signing or uses an interpreter. But to lose one's hearing later in life really can be devastating. Imagine what you might do tomorrow if you were to lose your hearing today. How would you communicate? And those are some of the most important problems that people that lose their hearing overnight that they deal with, how they communicate in their world. We rely heavily on the ability to hear. The person who is deaf or might not have the services of an interpreter leads an isolated life, or can lead an isolated life for someone who's lost their hearing especially. It's similar to sort of an isolated situation in a prison, for example. What I'm trying to say is that the services provided by DHHSD are vital to people. Other agencies can't serve people that have a hearing loss. There is a staff in the division that has a particular skill set that serves those people. And we need those services to grow and develop, not to go back to some older time when there wasn't the money available. We want to continue to build capacity in our deaf community. We hope that there will be a reinvestment into the agency. And I want to thank you for your time today and the opportunity to speak before you.
Thank you so much for being here. Our next testifier is Barry Siegel.
Yes, hello. My name is Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Barry Siegel, and I'm a deafblind individual myself. I'm legally blind. I did grow up in Minnetonka, and I currently live in Minneapolis. You were just hearing about people growing up being able to not to hear, and then they become deaf. For me, I was able to see until about 87, and then my sight got much worse. And I was quite young, 19 at the time, so it really changed my life. The kind of help that has helped me is support services providers. They really assist me to get out in the world. They're my eyes. They help me to run errands or be able to do activities or be out in the community. That's the person that can assist me by being the eyes for me and assist me in being able to go, for example, shopping or being able to buy my dog food that I might need, because I do have a service dog. For example, when I go into a pet store, I'm not able to figure out which food is what. But with a support service provider, I can be guided to the right section of the store to buy the right items for my dog. And also, when I was considering purchasing a couch, I was able to go with a support service provider and make sure that I got the right couch to meet my needs. And frequently, the hours that we have as support service providers has been cut. And I really need to be able to have those kinds of services every week to maintain my independence and to have my communication accessible out in the big world. So without that, I'm much more isolated. As I said, I grew up in Minnetonka. And, you know, you don't want to be that isolated. Even in Minneapolis, I can be very, very isolated without a support service provider. So thank you very much for your consideration of support of House File 1341.
Thank you so much for being here. And now we have Ms. Hsu. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I also want to thank Representative Pearson for being the chief officer of HF 1341. On the back of your packet, you'll see a photograph of my son Levi with his community intervener. Feel free to take a look at that as I talk about my son. My name is Danelle Hsu. I live in Minneapolis. And today I'm sharing the experiences of my son Levi Hsu, a five-year-old who is deafblind as a result of severe brain damage. It was Christmas time, and we were anticipating the birth of our first child, who would also be the first grandchild on both sides of our family. My pregnancy had gone beautifully, my contractions started, and we were all so excited. Then came the moment when our baby entered our world, and our world changed forever. He was born without a heartbeat or breath. He didn't move, and he didn't cry. Our son Levi was born with severe brain damage, and there was no reason to explain why. In the weeks that followed, we learned that Levi is deafblind and nonverbal. Today, Levi is 5 years old, and he has significant combined hearing and vision loss. His dual sensory loss gives him incomplete access to his environment. He has difficulty learning on his own using simple skills such as observing or independent exploring. He's different from a deaf child who can use their vision to compensate what isn't heard. He's different from a child with vision loss who can use their hearing to compensate for what they do not see. Levi is not able to rely on his vision or his hearing, two important senses that help us access information. This has made it difficult for Levi to understand what's happening to him, to understand the environment around him, and how to expressively communicate to friends, family, and the world around him. When Levi was 4 months old, we began working with early education specialists. This included special education teachers, OTs, PTs, deaf, hard of hearing, vision teachers, and all of whom were very top in their field. However, it wasn't until he was 2 years old that we were able to start working with a community intervener. That is when we saw a profound improvement in his ability to participate in life and communicate with others and the world around him, not until age 2. Deafblindness is unlike any other disability. Other programs alone do not work for Levi and kids like him. The vast majority of people do not have the specialized knowledge needed and the training necessary to provide Levi, a child with deafblindness. Interveners are the only people we have found that have this training. My family has been fortunate to have Anna Kors, who's the intervener that you see in the picture with my son Levi. She's the community intervener who works with Levi in our home, and she comes for just a few hours a week. Since Anna's began working with Levi, we have noticed that Levi has less anxiety, which makes learning possible. Levi understands basic cause and effect, which didn't happen until age 5. Prior to Anna, his intervener, he had no understanding of cause and effect. Levi is able to engage in meaningful, independent play. Prior to Anna, he needed full support at all times, someone helping him with every aspect of play. Levi is able to consistently now communicate his emotions to friends and family. Before Anna and working with an intervener, Levi stopped trying because he knew he wasn't understood. For Levi, an intervener has transformed his ability to participate in our family.
Thank you.
And in the world around him. His ability to learn has become possible. Studies and articles show that an intervener who's working with a child with deafblindness the child is able to access information and able to communicate and excel developmentally. With an intervener, a child with deaf blindness has an increase in communication. For Levi, it was just the beginning of starting to expressively communicate. A child with deaf blindness who's working with an intervener is engaged in their environment, in people, and in things and objects, even something as simple as a toy or something as complex as a learning tool. Without an intervener, the child is left isolated, even within the context of their family. These studies show positive reports that children who are deafblind improve developmentally. An example of an intervener is Helen Keller's teacher, Ann Sullivan. I personally have met many parents who have children with deafblindness throughout Minnesota who would attest to these same positive results. Children who, with the support of an intervener, have gone on to do the extraordinary, graduate from high school, attend college, participate in meaningful jobs. I believe that for Levi, his intervener support has greatly helped him achieve basic milestones. He is an example that early intervention and support from the beginning will continue to benefit him into the future. I'm asking for your consideration and your approval for more funding for deafblindness, to provide funding for more training for professionals and families who support people with disabilities, and services for children and families. These services are critical. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to address you today on a very serious issue that affects every family with a child with deafblindness throughout Minnesota. Please support HF 1341.
Thank you, Ms. Hsu, and thank you for sharing your personal story. It's very compelling. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak in favor or against this bill? Okay, I don't see anyone. I'm sorry. If you want to grab a seat and introduce yourself, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, since the parents painstakingly attached the blindfolds and the earplugs to your packets, if you could just, when you have time, not now, but just to attach and try the to putting, I'm Mary Hartman with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans, but if you could, when you have time, put earplugs in and blindfolds and try to do the simplest of tasks and just imagine what it's like. And so, and also just to add, there's an average of 2 to 4 hours a week of service that's provided to families and to adults. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pearson, to your bill, and then we'll go to member questions.
Go right ahead and open up for questions.
Okay, members, any questions? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a comment. I'm going to encourage all members, if they support this bill, to support House File 1440, which provides coverage for hearing aids for children.
Any other questions, members? Okay, seeing none, thank you so much, the testifiers, for taking the time to be here. With that, Representative Pearson will renew his motion that House File 1341, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pearson.
Thank you.
Members, the next bill on the agenda is House File 780. Representative Hamilton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And members, as Representative Hamilton comes forward, I will move that House File 780 be re-referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability. We have the bill in front of us.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. I understand you have an amendment.
And we're taking up House File 780 first, is that correct?
That is correct.
I do not have a copy of the amendment, Madam Chair. I apologize.
Okay. No, that's okay.
All right, yes, if I could get someone to move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like to.
Okay, Representative Hamilton, I will move the DE1 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Hamilton, two-year bill as amended.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This was actually brought to me by the MS Society, Minnesota Multiple Sclerosis Society as well. And in an essence of time, Madam Chair, I do have a testifier that would be able to walk us through the bill and then subsequently answer any questions we may have.
Okay, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill today. Again, my name is Dan Andreessen. I am the Public Policy Manager for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society's Upper Midwest Chapter. Our chapter serves over 11,000 Minnesotans who are living with multiple sclerosis to help them live their best lives. House File 780 is a bill to help Minnesotans who are elderly and living with a disability maintain their independence by modifying their homes to increase accessibility and safety. I'd like to thank Representative Hamilton for his leadership on this bill, which is also supported by several groups, including AARP, the Minnesota State Council on Disability, and the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. Almost all of us at some point in our lives will experience a disability, whether as a result of chronic disease, illness, developmental disability, accident, or age. As more people choose to age in place and people living with disabilities, including those with multiple sclerosis, seek the independence of living in their homes, they may face several challenges to keep the home safe and accessible. When living with a disability, the condition and functionality of a home can mean the difference between continuing to live in one's home and leaving it for nursing or long-term care. Without the proper equipment and modifications, a home can be a dangerous place for someone with limited mobility. Falling in one's home is one of the leading causes of visits to an emergency room or hospitalization for those who are elderly and living with a disability. Falls are physically and emotionally traumatic, can result in further hospitalization, rehabilitation, additional limitation, physical limitations, emotional trauma, and death. Minnesota has one of the highest fall rates in the United States, and incidences of falling are disproportionately higher for those who are elderly and living with a disability. In the older adult population, 1 in 3 adults over the age of 65 falls every year in the United States. This is a similar concern for Minnesotans living with a disability, including those with multiple sclerosis. Statistics show that due to MS symptoms associated with a loss of balance and motor control, over 50% of people with MS will fall within a 3 to 6 month period, and around 30 to 50% will fall multiple times. In order to remain safely in a home, modifications such as installing ramps, lifts, grab bars, widening hallways, and full room remodels are sometimes a necessity. However, many existing homes are not built for accessibility. Over a third of Minnesota's housing stock was built prior to 1960, and over half before 1980. Typically, these homes have multiple levels, narrow hallways, and small bathrooms. Updating a home with accessibility modifications is costly. According to the Center for Universal Design, these home modifications can range in price from $100 to upwards of $50,000. For example, installing an exterior ramp can cost around $3,000. Adding a no-step shower or bathtub can range from $8,500 to $12,000. Making these modifications can be a costly burden, especially to a population who already face financial challenges due to increased health care, pharmaceutical, and rehabilitation costs. For example, it's estimated that a person living with multiple sclerosis can spend upwards of $70,000 per year per person. The assistance granted in House File 780 would provide a mechanism to offset these costs and help Minnesotans who need home modifications to stay in their homes. To access this assistance, a homeowner would need to apply through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, which would be administrating the program. To be eligible, the homeowner would need to be over the age of 65 or living with a disability as certified by a licensed medical provider. The applicant would also need to be required to have an income below 450% of the federal poverty limit. All assistance provided must be used towards a home modification. Given the financial and staffing challenges of Minnesota's nursing homes and long care facilities, keeping residents in their homes as long as possible is a cost-effective option. In addition, continuing to live in one's home promotes emotional well-being and independence while maintaining a connection to their community. Thank you again for the opportunity to address the committee on this bill. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you so much for being here. I'll ask, is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. Members, questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a little question on the wording in the DE. And I know that this started out as the idea being for to do it as a tax credit, and it changed. And I wondered if the language on 2.21, where it says, and 2.22, where it says a qualified person means a taxpayer spouse, et cetera. And I just wondered if that was an oversight, because otherwise I'm not sure what it means. You'd have to go and prove you're a taxpayer to get the grant. So I just thought I'd point that out.
Mr. Andreessen, Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chairman, we were just talking about that, and we believe that that should probably be homeowner of something that we appreciate you pointing that out, and we would like to work on that in between. If we're so fortunate to have this pass out of this committee, we'll work on that as well.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Members, any other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I know this is a challenge that faces many people, and particularly with some diseases early in life, not maybe when it's more common. And I'm wondering if you might, as the bill continues to move on, think about whether or not an eligibility for the grant would also be moving assistance. I have a friend who is, because of continuing disability, the house that she had in the suburb, a multi-level, split level, it would have cost far more than the house would ever be worth to try and modify. It just wasn't a very practical sort of option. And she moved into accessible housing, is still working. And but, you know, you can imagine if you have physical limitations, packing up, moving, I mean, that's a risk in falling as well when you're trying to make those adjustments. And yet, for some people, moving to an accessible location may create better life options in some, at least some parts of the state, than trying to modify a home in an area where there maybe isn't good public transportation or other sort of supports that will actually give them some independence.
Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, thank you. We'll definitely look into that as well. And this is why we appreciate the process, so that we have the opportunity to take the testimony and try to make the bill even better. So thank you.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to thank the author for bringing this bill forward. I see out in our community where we have a lot of people who are hitting that 65 and older, and we've seen where it's so important to have the support services and allowing people to stay in their homes as long as possible. And I see this as another way to be able to continue that, because we know it's so much cheaper when people are able to continue to stay in their homes and receive services there. So I thank you for this great idea and wish you luck in continuing moving forward.
Thank you.
Okay, members, seeing no further questions, I will renew my motion that House File 780 as amended be referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. And Representative Hamilton, you have the next bill also, House File 1009. And so I will move that House File 1009 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And House File 1009 allows for the strengthening and expansion of the Nurse Family Partnership Program. And this is an evidence-based community health program targeted to serve first-time low-income moms and their babies. And they do have over 37 years of randomized controlled trial research proving its effectiveness. And Madam Chair, we do have some testifiers as well.
Okay. And Representative Hamilton, I also understand we have an A1 amendment. Is that your amendment, Representative Hamilton?
Madam Chair, is that my amendment? It is my amendment. Yes,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Excellent.
It is my amendment. So if I could get you or someone else to offer up the A1 amendment. And
sure thing. Members, I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And that was just clarifying language, so for the committee. Thank you for the support on that.
Perfect. So, Representative Hamilton, to your bill as amended, would you like to go to testifiers now?
Please.
Okay. So, whichever one of you would like to go first, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed, and we'll try to keep it to about two minutes per testifier.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Chelsea Pearsall, and I work with the Nurse Family Partnership. Nurse Family Partnership serves first-time low-income pregnant women starting early in pregnancy prior to 28 weeks gestation through the child's second birthday. Currently, the typical NFP mom in Minnesota is young, the median age is 19, unmarried, 89% of clients are single mothers, undereducated, 49% of clients have completed high school, low income with a median household income of $9,000 a year, and dependent on government safety net programs. In 2014, at intake, 64% of clients were on Medicaid, 28% were on food stamps, and 82% were on the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC. Nurse Family Partnership is an outcomes-driven data tracking, or is outcomes-driven. Data tracking and ongoing evaluation are built into programmatic funding and directly inform continuous quality improvement efforts. Demonstrated outcomes of this program include improvements in maternal and child health, child development and school readiness, positive parenting practices, family economic self-sufficiency, as well as reductions in childhood maltreatment, abuse, and neglect, childhood injuries and emergency department visits, and juvenile delinquency, family violence, and crime. NFP expansion will bring cost savings to the state of Minnesota. The RAND Corporation estimates a return of up to $5.70 for every $1 invested in the Nurse Family Partnership Program. And the Brookings Institution and Washington State Institution for Public Policy also have documented that NFP produces a positive return on investment for government and society. A recent model developed by Dr. Ted R. Miller from the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation estimates the cost savings to state and federal government of $17,445 per family and $11,491 to state and federal Medicaid. In Minnesota, Miller estimates the cumulative cost savings to Medicaid would be approximately $180 per visit by the time the child turns 23 months. Please refer to your handout on page 2 for additional information on the cost benefits. Lastly, I'm just going to briefly describe the three components of this bill. The first of which is to increase the Medicaid fee-for-service rate to $140 per visit to ensure sustainable and consistent funding for public health nurse home visiting across the state. Second is $1 million in one-time funding to support currently unserved community health boards and tribal nations for planning grants and startup of the Nurse Family Partnership Program. The National Service Office and Department of Health have had conversations with unserved community health boards and tribes that have interest in developing the Nurse Family Partnership or joining an existing program, but planning to develop either a multi-county or joint partnership, especially in greater Minnesota, as well as startup funding for nurse education and implementation is a barrier. Finally, we are asking for $2 million per year in ongoing funding to support programs to expand services for additional at-risk families. At this time, I would like to thank Representative Hamilton for bringing this forward and turn it over to Mary Jo O'Brien.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Mary Jo O'Brien. I'm the Executive Director of Supporting Hands Nurse Family Partnership. And we have a unique structure. We operate in 20 counties under what we call a joint powers agreement, and those 20 counties are in southwest Minnesota. And if you look at your map, they're the bright blue counties that cover about the southwest part of the state. We are governed by a joint powers board, and each one of our 20 counties sends a commissioner to our joint powers governing board, and we meet on a quarterly basis. We've had strong support for this nurse family partnership from the 20 counties, and we've been in existence since 2008. Currently, we are serving 178 moms, first-time moms, in these 20 counties, in Greater Minnesota, and we have a waiting list of 27. We have been adding nurses as we've been going along. We've actually doubled the number of clients that we serve since 2013. And we still, every time we bring a nurse on, we're full. And then we have also five counties that are contiguous to our counties that we serve that are asking if they can join Nurse Family Partnership, our organization, Supporting Hands. So there's need out there. The counties are so committed to this program that they provide and have been providing over 50% of the funding for this program over the years that we have been operating. And we receive about 30% of the fund of the operating budget from Medicaid and the health plans that are Medicaid health plans. We need additional Medicaid reimbursement to begin to serve the need in outstate Minnesota. We have offices throughout the 20 counties in public health agencies. The counties are gracious enough to give us in-kind office space in the public health agencies throughout the 20 counties. So I would really encourage your support for this bill. There's a great need out there, especially with our low-income, first-time moms. 97% of our moms, we get referred to the program from WIC, Women, Infants, and Children's Program. I would just encourage your support, and thank you, Representative Hamilton, for coming forward with this bill. I'd be open to any questions.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here today. Representative Hamilton, did you want to add anything, or we'll go to member questions?
Member questions.
Okay. And is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify to the bill? Okay. Not seeing anyone. Members, any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not really a question, but a comment. And just that I think this is one of the most important things that we can do for the state. And I really appreciate that you're here with this, Representative Hamilton. You're doing things for the elderly and the disabled, but also for the young. And I think that if we really think about it, you know, we keep hearing from our state economists that we need to invest in productivity for the future. That's how we're going to deal with the age wave, because we've got fewer young people and more older ones, and that's going to continue for a long time. So we can't afford, as a state, we just cannot afford to waste the talent of any child. And I think that this program really focuses on that and can really mean a difference in the lives of some kids and you know, really change the direction of what we would otherwise be dealing with as they grow older. And so thank you, those of you who do work in this area. I hope we can do this. I'd like to see us do a home visit for every family, because it isn't only the ones that are obviously at risk who could use a little initial information and support. And I'd like to even see it not just for a first child, but that every child born in Minnesota, that the family would get a visit from a trained home visiting person to offer resources, you know, and even just say, you know, welcome to the world. We, you know, it's important. We're interested in having babies in the state. You know, this is important, instead of what sometimes it seems like, oh, you're having a baby, you're on your own. That should not be the way. We can't afford to be that way as a state. So thank you very much for this bill.
Representative Hamilton.
Oh, no, thank you, Madam Chairman. And I did learn something from paying attention last time. I think that's thank you as well. Uh-huh. That was amazing. Last bill was absolutely amazing. Thank you.
I see a lot of that at home, actually. The only way I can get my son to communicate is using his hands right now. He doesn't like words, so I recognize that also. Members, any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Representative Hamilton, so much for bringing this bill forward. It's a great program. Members, I will renew my motion that House File 1009 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance as amended. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hamilton.
I didn't mean to be rude.
No. Okay. Next, Representative Cornish, we're going to go out of order here slightly, mostly because I forgot to tell Representative McDonald that we were ready for his bill. So we're going to grab him out of committee, and in the meantime, go to Representative Cornish's bill. So Representative Cornish, I will move that House File 7883 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And we have the bill in front of us. I'm not aware of any amendments.
No, Madam Chair, no amendments.
Okay. So with that, Representative Cornish, to your bill.
Madam Chair and members, what House File 783 is a enhancement of a penalty for somebody that assaults a direct contact worker in the described facilities there by statute, a secure treatment facility personnel, and then it describes it on line 1.1. What this comes from is a St. Peter and Anoka, the state hospitals, have had an uncommon rate of assaults on their personnel, on their workers, union workers, and to the rate of almost 10 of them in a week, or a little over a week. These assaults have been very dramatic, and members, I could have brought people up here, showed you pictures of swollen eyes and broken bones and different things, and the permanently disabled people that are now home at work, from work, that can't work any longer, that have been calling me on the phone begging me for this legislation. But I spared you from those graphic presentations, just decided to talk about it today. We've even had attacks, since they can't use restraints on these people. We've had violent attacks, even in a motor vehicle on the way to hospital, that serious injury resulted in a moving vehicle. And these haven't been addressed. And so one way, the piece of the apple here, what we've been trying to do different things at St. Peter is get an active response team like they do have in the sex offender unit and don't have in the mentally ill and dangerous. These, sometimes an excuse is given that these people are mentally ill and don't know what they're doing, but the workers say that these are planned out, sometimes diagrammed, methodical attacks on the personnel, and they do know what they're doing. And it's gotten so bad that now that they know that there's no consequence to suffer, we've had patients or clients know that if they stand back and put their hands up and say, well, I just had an episode, that nothing is done. County attorneys have told us that since they don't think of anything more, the enhanced penalty is worth any more than the penalty it's got, it's not worth charging. Instead, some of them agreed that the penalty should be enhanced. And the union represented down there is asking for your support on this bill and on these assaults. And there is one testifier I have with me, and Ethan, representing the folks down there. If I could have him testify, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Ethan Vogel. I'm a legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. And we do support this legislation, House File 783. And we thank Representative Cornish for his very important work in representing our members down there. This is a really straightforward bill, and it's a small but yet very important step that we can take here at the legislature to increase the safety for our employees and our workers. Of course, this isn't going to fix the whole problem, but it's our belief and our hope that it will help deter some of the violence against our workers. So on behalf of all of the employees who have gone home at the end of the day with black eyes and fight marks and broken ribs, and on behalf of anybody who's been spit on or had themselves covered in urine and feces from someone else, please support this bill.
Madam Chair,
Representative Cornish.
I don't have any other testifiers. I would ask that after the opposition testify that I'd be able to come back with a little bit of rebuttal.
Okay. Members, we do have one other person on the list, and then I'll see if there's anyone else who wants to testify. Ms. Siebert, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patricia Siebert. I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota Disability Law Center, which is the federal protection and advocacy program for people with disabilities in the state of Minnesota. As such, our program has responsibilities to investigate abuse and neglect and to protect the rights of people with disabilities, including people in institutions. I've worked at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid and the Disability Law Center for upwards of 30 years, and I've had many clients who have been committed as mentally ill and dangerous to the security hospital. The Disability Law Center doesn't object to the principle that serious volitional assaults by competent patients at MSH can be charged as felonies, and they can be charged as felonies right now. We are concerned with the enhanced sentencing penalties that would result from this bill, with almost no opportunity for judicial discretion in order to take the complex facts of these mentally ill individuals and their treatment issues into consideration. Under the fourth degree assault statute, if I assault a nurse in a hospital emergency room and give her a black eye or break her nose, as was mentioned earlier, I might get sentenced to 2 years, but I also might get less, depending on the circumstances and on judicial discretion. If I spit at that nurse, that's not even included in the fourth degree assault statute. In comparison, if I'm a mentally ill man committed under the MIND statute, or if I'm otherwise committed to the security hospital, and I am convicted of spitting on a staff person, this bill would require the court to commit me to the Commissioner of Corrections for not less than 1 year and 1 day and up to 2 years. The court or the prosecutor may not do otherwise under this bill. I would not be eligible for parole, probation, work release, discharge, or supervised release until I had served the full term of my imprisonment, at least a year and a day and up to 2 years. The only people that these provisions currently apply to are sex offenders at MSOP. This proposal prevents discretion or consideration of mitigating circumstances, as is possible for people who commit assault in the community. So there's no opportunity for the conviction to reflect related issues. Was the staff person following the patient's treatment plan? Was the staff person properly following the hospital's policies? Did the staff person instigate the incident? Is the patient being properly supervised? These things also happen at the security hospital. And having this sort of really stringent enhanced penalty also hampers opportunities for patients who are doing well and could be discharged. If the goal of the enhanced penalty provision is deterrence, I'm not sure that's very realistic. We are talking about a population that is seriously mentally ill, already having a hard time keeping it together and controlling their emotions, or they wouldn't be at MSH in the first place. We all want to see a reduction in staff injuries, but I question the extent to which this bill would get us there. If the goal of this bill is enhanced punishment, then we are in danger of sending the message that the value of these mentally ill, institutionalized human beings is somehow different and perhaps less than for those of us in the community who commit similar assaults. MDLC believes the current assault provisions in law are sufficient to protect staff at MSH in those instances where assaults by competent patients do occur. This would also allow the court, in the interest of justice, to use its discretion and judgment in sentencing those individuals. In the alternative, I would like to suggest that assaults on secure treatment facility staff could be added to the existing statutory provision for assaults on emergency room personnel in Section 609.2231, Subdivision 2. This seems more equitable to me. I find it disturbing that an intoxicated but not mentally ill man who assaults and kicks a person lying in the street with a brain injury can get 2 days of jail time and 100 hours of community service, while a mentally ill man being treated at the security hospital who spits at a staff person can get not less than 1 year and 1 day, no probation, no parole, and 5 years of conditional release. Further criminalization of patients will not fix the variety of problems at MSH, including staff and patient injuries. I did want to mention one other thing. There is a seclusion and restraint policy at the hospital. It's not correct that staff are not allowed to restrain patients. When that patient is engaged in behavior that's imminently dangerous to self or others, the restraint policy allows that person to be restrained. Thank you for your consideration of my comments.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair and members, without being disrespectful, little of what you heard is accurate. First of all, these people are very murderous and violent people down there, and the term mentally ill is a soft way of describing these people. These acts are horrific and damaging, and they're planned out. The employees were worried of this very thing coming from NAMI and some of the advocates, where it's been blame the worker, and asking, like was hinted in the testimony, did the staff person instigate this conduct? Most of these assaults are ambushes or planned out. I had an opportunity to get some of these notes or complaints from this organization, and I forwarded them to a county attorney that prosecutes these cases, and this is what they've had to say. They said this bill is not written any differently than any other criminal statute that gives a prosecutor discretion to charge a case, nor does it say that these patients would not be entitled to a competency hearing, Rule 20 hearing. The prosecutor will still have an opportunity to evaluate whether he or she thinks a person will be competent to stand trial. County attorney said this bill simply gives them a tool to deal with volitional conduct. There is a separation between mental illness and volitional conduct. If the person is determined to be incompetent to stand trial, the conduct was not volitional. The fiscal note specifically mentions that some of the people prosecuted under this bill will not be competent to stand trial. And I just wanted to make it clear that that this isn't a legal opinion from this attorney, but it's an attorney that prosecutes these cases. And this is, there's one, currently there's about 12 different occupations that a peace officer, firefighter, correctional guards that receive protection under an enhanced penalty. And we're just adding these work to these state hospitals. And Representative Hackbar said that he's having the same problem in Anoka in the Ways Committee, Ways and Means Committee, when this was brought up in the deficiency bill in St. Peter. So these tax, you know, I'd argue the case for mentally ill. Anybody that commits any assault, a serious assault on a person, whether they're in a hospital or not, could be called mentally ill. Otherwise, why would you attack somebody without reason and do serious injury like happens today? So I have a hard time with describing a mentally ill as an excuse. So I believe that there is discretion, that they would be able to pick out the certain people that they feel that did this on purpose and planned out, and that it's a good protection for the workers down there that are asking for your assistance. And I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Is there anyone else who wants to testify to this bill that's in the audience? Okay, not seeing anyone. Members, questions? Representative Mazin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have several questions. First of all, if they're convicted, would they be serving in the same facility where the assault took place?
Representative Cornish.
I don't know the answer to that, Madam Chair and members, if they would serve it there or if it would be under some special segregation or if it would be in a prison after they are deemed to be safe to let out. I'd have to check that out.
Okay. Representative Mazin.
I still have problems. They are in a facility where they are already deemed mentally ill, and I hear your comments, but I also know that I had a relative who had Alzheimer's and would act out as well, and I hear that they will go be further evaluated after this happens, but it still seems a peculiar thing to do to somebody that's already in a mental institution. But I also am aware of the attacks on the staff, and I guess the other question I have is when it is determined that somebody does have the propensity to act out and do some of these awful things, is it usually just one staff in the room, or is it two? For instance, like I'm envisioning, like if they're there to give medications, and if it's only one person and they have to turn to get the pills, is there anybody to watch that person while the staff person is performing the duty?
Representative Cornish.
I don't know if I can answer that directly. I know a lot of these attacks have taken place on a single person. And since there's no responding unit like the sex offender program has, they're at their mercy until they can call for help, and things happen in just a few seconds. And while I'm on that, one misleading part of the testimony from the testifier was saying that restraints could be used and the seclusion. Currently, that's really not the practice, because another problem is St. Peter has been cautioned and put on probation for too much restraints and seclusion. So even this doesn't help. Backing off, and that puts the workers at even more risk, and prescribes more of a need for these people to know that there's going to be some consequence. If they're not charged with anything serious and not restrained or secluded, that's why one more need for the law.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not a lawyer and don't know much about the legal system, but my understanding is that the facilities we're talking about are ones where people have been committed. They're not, you know, just people with minor mental illness. They're people who have had their decision-making about their own medical care taken away from them, and that many of them are actually deemed not able to stand trial because their functioning level is so low that they could not effectively understand what was happening. Until their mental illness is brought under a better level of control. And so if that's the case, that someone has been sent to St. Peter, one of these places, because their functioning level is so low they can't even understand what they've been charged with, you know, would... It feels like charging them with a felony puts them just in that same box again of being charged with something they can't understand. Is it appropriate for someone at that level of functioning then to go to into a correctional facility, or would the judge even order it? And maybe you could address that situation where you have these people who the court has determined are unable to understand and manage a court process at all.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair and Representative, I guess I would refer you back to the county attorney's letter in that jurisdiction that says that they don't lose their right. There's still prosecutorial discretion first, and then even if they decide to prosecute them, they have to be proven to stand trial, and the county attorney is not about to bring a court case to court thinking that he or she won't be successful in the prosecution. So I think there is screening already for whether to charge or not, or whether the person is competent to stand trial. So.
And Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair, one other question. Has this been used in other states and shown to have any impact on the level of assault, or are there other approaches? I mean, we've heard a lot about how they're changing the treatment and they're training staff on de-escalating and these other things with the expectation of having better outcomes. But are you aware of other states that have used this approach and seen any change in behavior?
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair and Representative, no, I'm not aware of any other states, or have I done any research on that. I can tell you that the St. Peter facility has a nationally highest or second to of assault rate, and it's not getting better. There's been some problematic areas where they're worrying about terming the assaults as aggressions and changing the name so it looks smaller, but they've got a real problem there, and like I say, this isn't a solve all, but at least these people know that, and believe me, they know anything we do here at the legislature gets back to the center the next day. At least they'll know that there's a consequence, and they can't just throw their hands up and say, I'm sorry, I had an episode.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cornish, we've heard in the governor's deficiency bill $10 million for this facility. We've seen millions of dollars in recent bonding bills and more proposals for moving forward. There's a lot of issues going on here, and I think it's very important for the committee to understand just how dangerous a place this is to work, and the issues that we're seeing are not all related to the building and to architecture. But we've got some real issues going on, particularly at this facility, that the committee is going to have to look at in more depth this year and next year, very, very likely. So I'd
just look forward to working with Representative Cornish from the safety side, especially as we move forward. And I'm really interested in hearing directly from people who work there, not necessarily the folks from the agencies or the union representatives, but actually people who are working there, because the emails that I'm getting are not necessarily all lining up with what we're hearing in the testimony. So I think this is something we need to pay close attention to in this committee and also in the Finance Committee.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cornish.
Might I add that it's St. Peter, this is, like I say, one bite at the apple. There's just one thing going on there after another. There's people that get out on release and stab their mother. There's people being pushed to the graduation program too fast and at a high rate of revocation. There's a suicide the other day when somebody killed themselves. There's been a murder there. It's just boom, 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 one thing after another, and this is just an attempt to put some controls on it.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. I'm not seeing any other questions on the list, members. So with that, Representative Mazin, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cornish, do you know if this has been an ongoing problem that is just being brought to us, or for some reason is this getting worse, and do you know the reasons?
Representative Cornish.
Be conjecture on my part about what I think what's going on there and management, but I've been working on it for 2 years steadily, researching, asking for all sorts of facts and forensic studies, and I've gotten a lot of data back, and so I've really looked into this. It wasn't a knee-jerk reaction of somebody get punched in the nose. I assure you, it these assaults, it's been a real crisis, and something that I've got volumes of information from the leadership there, and trying to impress on them the need for change.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, members, I see no further questions, and I do just want to correct my motion. Came to my attention that this does not have a fiscal note, so the motion will be to re-refer it to the General Register. So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 783 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion. The motion does not prevail.
Division.
There's a division being called for. Please raise your hand. All those in favor? Those opposed, please raise your hand. Okay, members, there are 12 ayes and 4 noes. The motion prevails. My hearing was incorrect. Thank you, Representative Cornish.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Members, we're going to take things just slightly out of order. We're going to take up my bill, House File 1790, just due to the fact that the advocates have to be in the Senate on the same bill tonight.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1790.
Very well. Be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And I'm not aware of any amendments. So, Representative Mack, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, House File 1790 deals with the consumer-directed community support service that we have here in the state, which allows individuals with disabilities to have an individualized annual budget and greater flexibility in creating their support system with oversight provided by the county and the fiscal support entity. In 2004, CDCS services were expanded to all waivers and the state took over the budget methodology. This budget methodology did not include an increase for individuals when they left school, and therefore many individuals left the consumer-directed option and were forced to choose less flexible, more costly service options that did not include an increase to cover employment or day supports. Consumer direction allows individuals and their families greater flexibility in creating support systems, resulting in a more cost-effective service delivery system. Consumer-directed services support the state's Reform 2020 initiative, as well as the Olmstead Plan. Remember, the bill in front of you would correct a longstanding issue within the CDCS budget methodology to ensure that folks, once they're out of school and over the age of 21, still have the incentives to stay within the confines of the CDCS program, which is more cost-effective and has an extremely high approval rating by the people who use it. They really like the flexibility it offers. And so, members, this bill tries to get at that issue, making sure that we are allowing that to be a viable option for people as they are out of school and over the age of 21. And with that, I have some testifiers here who can speak in more detail to the importance of the legislation.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Pedersen. I'm with Lutheran Social Services and Partners in Community Support, where we do CDCS services. The program is described fairly well there, so I won't repeat that. Just a few statistics that we have on the program. The average wage for direct care staff in this program is over $14 an hour, which is unheard of in disability services for sure. Staff turnover in this program is less than 1% a year, which is unheard of in almost any business or any program. It has very high levels of satisfaction, and the budgets that people are using in this service are generally 30% less than they would receive if they chose a different service, a more formalized service. So the service is provided, the service being provided is a high value to both the recipient and to the taxpayers. That said, most people leave this program around June 1st of the year they turn 21. Why? It's simple math. At age 21, they leave the public school system, and now they have a need for additional funding for their employment or day supports. If they remain in that self-directed program, they'll have to meet all of those needs within a budget that's already 30% less than it would be otherwise. If they give up self-direction, not only do they get that additional 30%, but they also get additional funding for employment and day services. The choice is between squeezing all of those, their service needs into a reduced budget or leaving self-direction for a higher cost service that has less control. The vast majority reluctantly choose to leave self-direction. Now, this bill would allow them to remain on their current self-directed program, giving them access to those additional employment and daytime service dollars while staying in the CDC within the confines of the CDCS program. They would then be able to manage these dollars as well, creating a plan that meets both their needs at home and their employment needs. They'd be able to have the same amount of services at a lower cost. They'd be able to spend more on innovation, achieving better outcomes, spend less on administrative costs that come with provider-controlled services. They'll be able to improve their ability to secure a real job for real pay in the community. We need an innovative approach, and we have one in CDCS. We just need an adjustment to this budget methodology to make that service available to those over the age of 21. Minnesota is a leader in self-direction for people with disabilities. However, we also have the highest percentage of people with disabilities in facility-based employment at 72%. In 2012, only 17% of people with disabilities were working in community integrated settings. In 2013, that number dropped to 13%, which ranks us 38th in the nation. We need innovation, we need flexibility, we need individualized plans, we need seamless integration between the services that people get at home and the services that they get at work. We need a budget methodology that allows people to meet their changing needs quickly and efficiently, and self-direction does that. This bill offers a new approach to employment for people with disabilities while preserving a person's ability to remain in self-directed services that have resulted in low administrative costs, high wages, and unprecedented staff retention rates. Both the Centers for Medicaid Services in Washington and our own Olmstead Plan in Minnesota require us to increase community integration for employment for people with disabilities, and this bill helps us move in that direction. People with disabilities want to work. They want to work in the community. They want the flexibility in their services to make that happen. They want the dignity and independence that comes with a real job and real pay. This is a small change to a budget methodology that leverages a huge impact on people's lives. I encourage you to support this bill and follow along over the next few years and watch the results that it has. Thank you.
Thank you. And your other testifier? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lori Richardson. My son is Ryan, and he's 22 years old. As a single mom of a boy with disabilities, I've always had to fight for his rights in school and now in the workplace, and it's proven to be monumental or tough at best. As he grew, his challenges grew as well, and the county, he was on a traditional waiver. At that point, the county had said, you know, it was, we were at a point that they couldn't provide the services that he was requiring, and his option was either to go into a group home facility or I could possibly stay home. There was no question. The only viable option for my son was for me to come home. With his diagnosis, his behaviors would increase and create grave danger to my son if he was moved out of the home. So I came home, and in the best interest of Ryan, the county and I decided together as a team that the CDCS program was the best option. As a single mother, though, that meant that I was coming home and I was then losing my income, which was from $65,000 down to below $20,000. I've done everything possible to continue his care, but it's a huge impact on my family. So despite the dramatic drop in income, the CDCS program has been a success for us in several ways. It empowered me to come home. It allowed him to receive the one-on-one care that he so desperately was in need of, and provided behavioral supports within the home. So learning to cope and manage with these behaviors has him going in the right direction. Being at home has also protected him from imminent harm. What CDCS did not do was provide supportive employment funding. Without supports, my son is not able to find or keep a job, and he certainly tried. He's had four positions within a year and a half's time, and none of them have worked. I have gone to great lengths to protect him. I have sat in the parking lot of one of his positions, and it was at evening in St. Cloud near our home, and I sat in the parking lot while he worked so that I could diffuse escalations. I could diffuse anxiety, or if he was getting off task, I could run in, and I was available to help my son. That's not a long-term solution. My heart is there, but it's not a long-term solution. What's needed is the funding to pay for support staff, to redirect my son, to give him direction, and to rope him in so that he can be successful. What we need, it's critical. It's absolutely critical to the success for him. We need a system of services that empowers people with disabilities and their families to meet their needs. This bill will add a missing key component to help empower our families. Supported Employment Services funding. It will allow a program to be put in place and give support to adults like my son, who desires to be a viable, tax-paying, contributing member of society. Thank you for your time and your consideration for such a critical piece of legislation to help my son.
Thank you for your testimony. Thanks. Are there any other testifiers that you have, Representative Mack? Are there any other testifiers from the audience that would like to speak to this bill? Okay, then we will move on to member questions. Members, any questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I hope that this is one of our budget priorities when it goes to the next committee, and thank you, Representative Mack, for bringing it forward. I think of all the money we as a state invest in other kids who are at age 21 are forging their adult lives, and to take this group of kids and actually reduce the level of supports
at a time they're trying to move on to greater independence is really critical. And I didn't realize we were that bad, that we're 38th in competitive employment. But when NCSL was here this summer, I heard a speaker, and the state of Washington is at almost 70% are employed in competitive wages, bringing home real paychecks, not sub-minimum wage. And we've got to, as a state, really move on creating these opportunities for people to actually fulfill their own dreams and also reduce the dependency that we have on programs that really aren't really fitting anymore. I think that many of them were designed at a time when we had people coming out of situations before we had special education where they were in, you know, state hospitals. They just didn't have the exposure to life that are now our graduates who've been in our school systems up to age 21 have had. So I'm hoping that we can really start moving on this. I think it's going to be a long-term part of the solution to our budget problems as well when these people are able to be more self-sufficient and successful in their lives. And we shouldn't be asking parents to do as much as Ms. Richardson did, but I'm sure it's created some opportunities for your son he wouldn't have had otherwise.
Thank you. Any further questions? Otherwise, Representative Mack, any closing comments?
Just briefly, Madam Chair, I really appreciate the testifiers coming and sharing their personal stories. I think it really highlights just how great of a need this is. And just keeping in mind that the CDCS program it creates great flexibility and has high satisfaction with the people that use it, but it's also a great tool for the state that we recognize savings and a better delivery system for many of our folks with disabilities. So to what extent we can help promote that program and make sure that it stays sustainable, that's what I'm interested in doing. So with that, I appreciate the support of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Mack. And with that, she renews her motion that House File 1790 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way. So our next House file is 976, Representative McDonald, if you want to get set up.
Representative McDonald, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I will move that House File 970, maybe Representative Peters already did this, but just in case, I will move that House File 976 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill before us, and so Representative McDonald, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we begin, Madam Chair, would you like another Halls?
I'm good for now. I've got cups of tea, Representative McDonald.
Yes, that darn cold is going around. I've had it myself. So, anyway, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving my hearing this bill a hearing. It's nice to be back in front of the Reform Committee again. My bill will minimize the barriers to admission to a very important mental health services that we currently have right now in the state of Minnesota. And here's a little history of what happens. When an individual is experiencing a mental health crisis and feels that they need to go to a safe place where they can stay temporarily to cope with this crisis, a service called Mental Health Crisis Residential Services is available in many Minnesota counties throughout the state. These services provide individuals to mental health services, a facility where they can just stay for a few days until their mental health crisis is under control. House File 976 streamlines that process that provides of this for the providers of this service that have to go through to get reimbursement for the services that they provide. And in doing so, will increase access to the critical health services for Minnesotans experiencing mental health crises. So right now, under current state statutes, individuals and providers have to go through a number of time-consuming steps to access payment for this service. And because this is meant to be a very temporary service to begin with, These steps are often cumbersome and often not completed on time until the individual leaves. The result is that the provider is not being reimbursed for the very important services that we as the state of Minnesota gave the authority to do so. Enactment of this bill streamlines the process, and changes proposed in this bill will allow individuals and providers to focus on the more important task at hand, dealing with the mental health crisis issue. Supporting individuals to work through their mental health crisis is very important, instead of having to focus on complicated and time-consuming eligibility paperwork. Now, members, can you imagine when you go into a doctor, a clinic or hospital, something not necessarily an emergency, but it's your emergency, a dental, you got an abscess tooth, and you got to sit down and go through all this paperwork. Now imagine if you have some mental health crisis that you're not thinking clearly, mentally, and yet we have these time-consuming and often over-redundant and duplicative paperwork that has to be done for these mental health crisis folks. Not in addition to those, the providers that are trying to help the individuals. So this bill streamlines that process. It's already in state statute. I encourage you to include it in the omnibus bill. Matter of fact, I would certainly be appreciative that it had its own standalone bill, but whatever the chair so deems necessary. With that in mind, that's my presentation of the bill. I will turn it over to my testifier, who will go briefly into a little bit more details of what this bill does. And my testifier today is Eric Nelson, and he's with the People Incorporated Mental Health Services. And you will explain a little bit more about this detail. So, Eric, state your name and who you're with, and for the record.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. My name is Eric Nelson. I work for People Incorporated Mental Health Services, and I'm here today on behalf of the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota. Mental Health Crisis Residential Services is a critical program where individuals can access services and supports for a short time while dealing with a mental health crisis. Medical assistance pays for the service component of the crisis residential service, and GRH pays for the room and board portion. This bill aims to relieve some of the administrative burden of securing the GRH payment. The current process for seeking reimbursements for room and board does not align with the structure of how the service is provided. As a result, it is difficult and time-consuming for providers to be reimbursed for providing this service. Currently, when an individual seeks out this service, the provider works with them to fill out an application form to begin the process of determining eligibility and securing payment from the county. The application is sent to the county, but it can take weeks for the county to get back to the provider, often with a request for further information from the individual, such as bank statements and other income verification documents. The average stay in crisis residential treatment services is about 3 to 5 days, so by the time the provider hears back from the county about additional documentation needed, the individual has often long since left the service. As a result of this system, clients are denied eligibility and coverage for the service, not because they don't meet the eligibility requirements, but because the provider is unable to locate them to produce the county requested additional paperwork. Providers are often left uncompensated for providing these mental health crisis residential services to individuals who are most likely eligible for the service. What this bill would do is, if someone is receiving medical assistance, it is assumed that they are eligible for group residential housing, the room and board funding stream for mental health crisis. When an individual accesses the service, the provider would verify that the person is receiving medical assistance and alert the county that the individual will be accessing mental health crisis residential services. And the county would then move forward with payment for the service. This bill would minimize barriers to admission to this critical service by streamlining eligibility so that providers can more easily be reimbursed for the service, and would help providers and the individual to focus on addressing the mental health crisis at hand. Thank you for your consideration. I would ask for your support with this bill, HF 976.
Thank you so much for being here. And members, just for clarification, you did have a A1 amendment in your packets, but that has been withdrawn, I understand. Correct, Representative McDonald?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify to this bill? Okay, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Ben Ashley Wertman from the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. As you've heard from us on many other bills, residential crisis is an important and key strategy in reducing inpatient hospital utilization. Data from DHS has shown us that there's about a 95% diversion success rate from folks who would have otherwise met the inpatient hospital level of care. On behalf of all of our clients whom we work with on many eligibility issues, and we know the difficulty in getting all of those, you know, papers in a row, we sincerely thank the providers for bringing this forward and for helping make residential crisis a fast, responsive, and credible option for Minnesotans in need. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Okay, we'll go to members' questions. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is, first of all, thank you, Representative McDonald, for this great bill. But what I'm wondering is on the GRH, we had on Monday, we had the one GRH bill that came through that was 14 pages long in changes. And what I was kind of wondering, because it was so encompassing, I don't know if what you're referring to in here was modified somehow in what the amendment was that we were dealing with in the bill on Monday night. And I'm wondering if they're somehow connected or not. And that, so I'm seeing heads nodding back in the, so they're not connected at all. So what he's referring to here would not be impacted by what we did the other night. Okay, that's where my question was coming from. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just maybe to the testifier, just as I'm looking at the language of the bill, it says the individual may receive concurrent group residential housing payments when receiving licensed residential crisis stabilization services. I just want to be assured that we're not duplicating payments here. Is there any, does this allow for duplication of payments? You're in GRH and then you're getting these other services. Is it just adding a service to what we're, that you wouldn't be getting otherwise? Can just explain it, please.
Mr. Nelson.
Not sure about that.
Madam Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, well, this is the government, Representative Liebling. We don't do anything duplicative here. Do we?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, you are the government.
No, Representative, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, yes.
Representative McDonald, I hesitate to call on you, but Representative McDonald.
Did I offer you a halls yet? Well, yes, Representative Liebling, you are. We, the people, are the government. I guess I am a person, so I'll accept that. Is there a testifier? Would you like to answer that question?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Mack and committee members. My name is Ani Simons, representing the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota. And to your question, Representative Liebling, we added that language after some discussions with stakeholders just to ensure that if there's a situation where someone is residing in a setting where they're receiving group residential housing long-term and they need to go access this very short-term service for 2 to 3 days, that their more long-term GRH funding is not, it doesn't end while they're in this very, very temporary service, and they're able to go back to that more long-term housing.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I could certainly see that that could be very useful and important, but as I'm looking at the language, it doesn't seem to put any limits on that. I mean, really, doesn't this kind of put us at risk of paying twice for somebody to have, we're paying to reserve their spot, and then we're paying for them to be in another setting, and
so
there's no limit, so in theory this could go on for quite some time, right?
Ms. Simons.
Chair Mack and committee members, because crisis residential services is, the average stay is 3 to 5 days, there would be the potential for a very short time for there to be two funding streams going on for GRH, but what we heard from a lot of folks involved in these discussions was that it would be more problematic if GRH funding for the long-term housing was prohibited and ended while the person was in this crisis service. They would then be coming out of a very temporary crisis service and would have, in the meantime, lost the funding for their long-term housing, which seemed to lead to more negative consequences for that individual trying to deal with that mental health crisis.
Yeah,
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, and I can certainly see that. I think that's a very legitimate argument. I just wonder, maybe Representative McDonald would like to, between now and the funding committee, I don't know what if the fiscal note is going to be on this now, but I'd be more comfortable if there was a limit even if it was a limit well beyond what you think a person would need. But I just think leaving it open-ended like this, I don't know how that's going to affect the fiscal note, but I don't know. But I would just ask Representative McDonald to give that some thought between now and the next committee.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, yes, thought has been given, and I'm thinking now, actually, and I share your concern with double billing. So I will work with the stakeholders and ensure that we tighten up that area of concern.
Okay, any other questions, members? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 976 as amended, House File 976 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members.
Thank you, Representative McDonald.
You're welcome.
Okay, members, just one moment. Okay, members, we are going to just consulting with fellow committee members. We're going to try to get one more bill done. Representative Norton has House File 1350. Welcome to the committee, Representative Norton. I will move that House File 1350 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill in front of us, but there's no amendments. Is that correct, Representative Norton?
Well, Madam Chair, sadly, there's no amendments. There was supposed to be one, and it didn't. It disappeared, and it was to alleviate some of the concerns that MnDOT have. Yeah. We'll just take it in finance. I don't know what happened to it. It just didn't arrive.
Okay.
So sorry about that.
Mysterious things happen around here, Representative Norton. Yeah, it's a transportation issue, Representative Dean said. Okay, so with that, to your bill, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is not a new issue for most of you, for the freshmen perhaps, but for the rest of you, this is a concern and an issue that's been around for quite some time. The bill we have before you is as a result of the OLA report. Representative McDonald, who I think has skipped out, was the GOP House member that served on that particular committee with me, and I've also been serving on it for the past 3 years. As a result of the OLA report, a task force was put together. This is a continuation of the work of the task force and making some additional changes to basically fund what was put in law last year. I think these are some more components that we're moving ahead. We've been doing it in parts, much to the frustration of many. So this is the official work of the Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Advisory Committee. Sue Abderholden, who is to my left and will be speaking to it, chaired the committee for most of the time, or all the time, most of it. We passed language last year, but funding wasn't available to implement the full recommendations at that time, and so we're moving ahead with a little bit more. The non-emergency medical transportation providers are well deserving of the increases that are included as part of this larger package, but several funding sources are listed in this bill, and we'll talk to those in a few moments. Minnesota has been woefully underserved, underserved the ATS-STS population compared to other states when it comes to public transportation. So another component of this bill, along with the provider increases, are also trying to move more people off of provider services and into public services, whether it be transit or personal reimbursement or volunteer mileage, which is really quite prevalent in the rural parts of our state. And as I said, MnDOT, who joined us, had done some research on this and found out that most states do a far better job than we do. Much higher percent of their populations in other states are on public transportation or transit. than Minnesota. So again, along with that public transit, the personal reimbursements for their own mileage, volunteer mileage reimbursements are also included in this bill. So what we're trying to do here is professionalize and raise the standards of the industry through a vehicle and driver registration and inspection. Well, the vehicles will be inspected, not the driver. The driver's just going to be registered. But this will be for all providers, ATS and STS, both, as we're combining and remodifying that program to delineate modes of transportation rather than the type of vehicle that's being used. Those increases or those changes in the vehicles and the licensing are being paid for by a fee, which was long debated at the committee, and I've heard at least in the Senate side, there were some concerns raised about that, but this suggestion was long debated, as I said, and supported by the members of the committee. And I think you have a letter that I've handed out from one of the providers who couldn't be here today, I think, saying as much. They do understand that this will help weed out the bad players and increase better providers all across the state with this activity. So this is not a completely fulfilling the desires of the task force or the advisory committee, because we still need to implement the web-based service and moving it from the state to more county-based services. But again, the department has to they're putting out RFPs and they're trying to find out what that web-based service would look like. There are a number of options out there. And so there's some comfort language for the counties that you'll see in here that says this won't be moved to the counties until and unless the state has stepped forward and funded the whole process so that they aren't saddled with something they can't afford. So you'll see that language in there too. And with that, that's just a quick overview. Actually, I want to compliment Randall Chun, who did a fabulous job of reviewing for all of you kind of line by line what each of the changes mean, and it was very well done. So that should be a resource for you as well. And with that, Madam Chair, Sue Abderholden is here.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI and the co-chair of the Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Task Force. This has been a very difficult end product to get to. There's, for whatever reason, a lot of different personalities on the committee and different interests, but what you see is close to being, 100% supported by the task force. I think the big thing is that last year you actually put into place much of what we wanted to do. We have, ATS and STS. We want to make it just one single administrative structure, which is what the OLA wanted. In order to move there, we had to make sure that the ATS providers actually meet the same standards as everyone else. Last year, we had no idea how many vehicles that would mean, so we were really just coming up with a fiscal note. So instead, what we did is everyone had to, ATS providers had to apply for variance during this past year, so we know how many vehicles are interested, and that's how we got to actually the dollar amount for the decal that everyone will now have. So we think that's a really good first step forward. In order to really get rid of ATS and STS, we have to actually fund the modes. So we're not going to talk about whether someone's door-to-door, door-through-door, curb-to-curb, and all that kind of stuff. It's whether someone needs help or not, however far that might be. We did add in a couple of new modes last year, including protected transport, which we haven't been able to implement because there hasn't been any funding. A big part of it, as Representative Norton said, is we want people to use the cheapest form of transportation possible, which is actually someone driving their own car or a family member driving it. But we had the mileage rate so low, and we have people who are on very low incomes, that there was no really incentive to do that. So in the bill, we proposed actually increasing that along with increasing volunteer mileage, so we're using, frankly, the cheapest mode possible. The other thing I just wanted to mention that's a part of this is that it eliminates the 4.5% cut for all NEMT providers, both fee-for-service and for managed care. That cut was made during the recession, and we believe it's important for that to come back. And in addressing the rural areas of the state, the ATS providers in the past weren't able to benefit from what they call RUCA, so kind of the rural kind of add-on that you get when you're in the very rural areas. So now ATS providers would also get that, which actually might bring in some more providers in some of the rural areas of the state. And then lastly, we want to make sure that we're not having this all go into place at once on July 1st. So you'll see there's some variance language in there so that we kind of have a rolling method of getting everyone kind of up to speed. So I think it's a good bill. I think it moves us in the right direction, and I would encourage you to support it.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience wants to testify to this bill? I do know, and probably a lot of people on this table that have been on this committee know, that this has been a very painstaking process. And kudos to you, Representative Norton, to sticking to it, as well as Ms. Abderholden and all the people involved in this process. And so we do have a couple of questions, and I'll just let members know. I'm hoping to wrap this up by 4:45 out of respect for the DFL caucus that will be coming in. If we don't finish by then, we'll be reconvening and can finish. It'd be nice to wrap up before then, but if we need more time, we can do that. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just quickly, I hope that in the continuing work that some of the values you've just described will be applied to the metro area, because public transportation, I just went to a transportation committee hearing, and at rush hour to get 3 miles in my city from my house to there would have taken 45 minutes in a transfer, and that's the best you'll ever get, to go 3 miles. So some people going to a medical appointment, it might be 3 hours and 2 transfers, and they'd much prefer that we developed a volunteer system. But when you have 20 to 25% of my residents don't even have a single car, it's harder to organize. And last winter, when we had the horrible massive snow dump, getting 6 blocks was impossible if you were at all had some mobility issues. And I didn't hear, and I don't see in the language, just quick skimming it, the adjustments that could say you could take the bus maybe when the weather's good, but then in the winter we'd arrange for something else. So if we could just keep looking at that.
It's in there, but Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, actually in the policy manual, yeah, it is in there, because we wanted to make sure that maybe an elderly person, when it's icy out, wouldn't take the bus. And actually conversely, in the heat of August, someone who has schizophrenia and they don't sweat because of the medications also don't want to be out in the hot heat. So we did put that into the policy manual.
Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1350 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. And members, if you wouldn't mind just in turning the getting the table cleaned up really fast, because we're going to House File 5, if you wouldn't mind just putting all the stuff that you don't want. Oh, we'll be in room 5 at 6:15. Sorry. Room 5, 6:15. If you could just put what you don't want in front of your spot, and then make sure everything you still want in your folder, in your safe folder, that would be very helpful just for quick cleanup. With that, members, we are in recess. Members, we're going to reconvene the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform, and we're going to take up representative. Thank you to the loyal few who are here.
That's right.
Okay, so we're going to take up Representative Franzen's bill, House File 1258. So Representative Franzen moves that House File 1258 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill in front of us. No amendments, Representative Franzen, I understand. So to your bill.
That is correct. And, you know, since it is 2-1, just let you know that the other two authors are DFLers, so don't vote against me there. I think we'll smooth through. House File 1258 would create a grant program to develop culturally appropriate education advocacy programs about the importance of organ donation and cooperation within historically underserved communities. This proposal aims to build on and expand the good work currently being done by Hennepin County Medical Center with their Circle of Life, a federal grant with a number of tribes across the state. That project is slated to conclude at the end of 2015. House File 1258 would allow that work and momentum to continue. And with me, I have Susan Mao Larson from LifeSource and Barb Danielson from HCMC to provide more information.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chairman and committee members, my name is Barb Danielson, and I am the transplant nurse administrator at Hennepin County Medical Center. I'm here today to express support for 1258, a bill to establish a grant program to increase donation among minority communities. I've worked at HCMC in the transplant program for over 30 years, and I've witnessed many hardships in underserved communities. As you know, HCMC functions as a safety net hospital supporting Hennepin County and the state of Minnesota. HCMC performed the first kidney transplant in the Upper Midwest in 1963 and performs about 20% of all kidney transplants in Minnesota, with 46% of all the Asians in Minnesota, 25% of all Latinos, 45% of individuals from African origin in Minnesota, and 75% of American Indians. American Indians experience an excessive burden of chronic kidney disease, and in fact, they're 6 times more likely to have kidney disease due to diabetes than Caucasians. Transplantation is the treatment of choice and the most cost-effective treatment for patients with chronic kidney disease. Minority transplant rates fall far below those of transplant rates in the Caucasian population. One of the barriers for minority communities is access to education regarding kidney donation and transplantation, any kind of transplantation. And our mission at HCMC is to educate all communities, but especially minority communities. In 2012, we applied for and we were awarded a 3-year HRSA grant to develop a new approach to providing culturally based living kidney donation education in places where American Indians receive community-based health services. This project is being conducted in collaboration with South Dakota State University and LifeSource, and it's called Circle of Learning for American Indians, Living Kidney Donation Education. The package that's delivered looks like this. It has written materials and visual materials, and it's delivered by tribal outreach coordinators in the communities, and it's delivered by members that are trusted in the community. They have a close connection with the medical team for questions, and we believe that the educational materials and the outreach coordinators will be a valuable resource for the community once the project is completed this year. To date, the feedback from the community is extremely positive. The bill would be would allow us to support what's needed to extend this work into other minority communities, not just the American Indian community, and it would benefit all populations in Minnesota and all transplant centers in Minnesota and beyond that. Please support this important bill, and thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Susan Mal Larson, and I serve as the Director of Public Affairs for LifeSource, and I'm here to support House File 1258. LifeSource is a nonprofit organization, and we are designated by the federal government to manage all organ donation that occurs after death for Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. So we're the only organization in those three states that does this work. A critical component of our mission is to provide education and outreach so that people in our communities have information about donation at the time that they renew their license or make a decision of whether or not they want to be a donor. We're fortunate in Minnesota because 64% of Minnesotans have registered as donors, which is higher than the national rate of 50%. But sadly, there's more than 3,200 people in our state that are waiting for a life-saving transplant. And every day, 21 of those people die because they don't get the transplant they need. We know that some communities in our state have demonstrated a lower rate of support for donation. The Native American community in particular, on average, about 30% of those who could be donors actually say yes to donation. And as Barb said, they have a really high need for transplantation. So our hope with this bill is to be able to provide education and outreach in collaboration with the Native American community so that they can have information about donation and hopefully raise their level of support for donation. The way this bill is written is this would be a grant program through the Department of Health, and it would be available to donation agencies and transplant centers. We have 4 transplant centers in the state of Minnesota: Hennepin County Medical Center, University of Minnesota, Mayo Clinic, and Abbott Northwestern Hospital. As I said, we're the only organization that manages organ donation, and we also partner with the Minnesota Lions Eye Bank. So all of these organizations would be able to work in collaboration to implement these programs. We also know it's very important to collaborate with the Native American community, and we've reached out to the Indian Affairs Council, and they have adopted a resolution in support of this bill, and I believe that that's available in your materials. And we have reached out to the Department of Health, and they have said that this proposal aligns with their work around addressing health disparities, and they have no concerns with the language. So we think this is an important bill. We think that it can really help us do some outreach and potentially save lives, and we ask for your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for the bill or against the bill? Don't see anyone. Members, questions? Okay, don't see any questions. So Representative Franson will renew her motion that House File 1258 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thanks to the DFL for helping pass this bill.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Okay, next we will take Representative Backer. And the first bill of yours we'll take up is House File 1073, Representative Backer. And I will move that House File, or I'm sorry, Representative Backer will move that House File 1073 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Not aware of any amendments, Representative Backer, if that's correct.
There is none. That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. And Representative Backer, two-year bill.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1073, you know, we've seen several bills over the last weeks, a lot of changes. This one's really simple. We have one word, constant, and we remove it in four places, but it is significant. I'll give you an example. What this bill does is we have mentally disability individuals who have the physical capacity to live on their own, but they almost live on their own, I should say, but they need direction. They need direction to, okay, let's wash the dishes today. Let's also put the laundry away. They need that type of direction. And that's really what this bill does. It defines dependency on not just that they need constant help 24 hours a day, but they need direction. This provision, constant, really penalizes people who have mental disabilities but not physical disability. And also some of the things that we've seen with this type of bill that affects people with mental illness is it's eating the proper food, picking up the spoon to eat the food, making good choices. Physically, they're okay, but mentally, they need that type of direction, and that's what this bill helps to do by eliminating that one single word four times. We estimate that there's approximately 1,200 people who need this type of daily supervision. Some might be 2-3 hours, others may be 6 hours, but they don't need 24/7. And with that, Madam Chair and committee members, I'll turn it over to a testifier.
Thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Disability Law Center at Legal Aid, where we represent children and adults with long-term significant disabilities across Minnesota. First, thank you very much, Representative Backer, for bringing this issue forward. The eligibility for what is now the Personal Care Assistant Program, PCA, and will become a new name, Community First Services and Support, sometime in the latter part of next year, we're told. This originated in cuts in 2009, and it hasn't been addressed since that time. And basically, what happened is that the same restrictive eligibility criteria in the current PCA program is brought over in the new legislation, and that's why this bill is here. We think it really is time to restore this program to all people with disabilities, whether they're physical or whether they are just unable to do the tasks they need to live more independently because of a mental illness, increasing dementia, a brain injury, or intellectual and developmental disabilities. The way that it works is that people who have physical disabilities just have to qualify as needing hands-on assistance. And the law doesn't say they need constant hands-on assistance. They can do whatever they can do, and then they get help with what they can't do. But if you don't have a physical disability, you have to have the need for constant supervision. And for people who can do some things if they're prompted, like get up, it's time to get up, or we need to take medication now, they're absolutely prevented from getting the little help they need to stay independent in the community. So we would really appreciate your support for this bill and to move it forward. And with that, I'll turn it over to Sue Everholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Sue Everholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I just want to add to what Ms. Henry said. You know, these individuals would actually qualify for a nursing home or, you know, kind of a residential placement, but they would not qualify for those in-home daily supports. And the way to kind of think about it is if someone has quadriplegia, it's pretty clear that they're going to need help holding onto that spoon to feed themselves. But if someone has schizophrenia and they have disorganized thoughts and they have, you know, they're hearing voices and things like that, they may forget to eat. They may not go get groceries. They may not remember, now wait, how do I make this recipe or how do I scramble these eggs? And so they need someone to cue them and say, okay, this is what you need to do. We have a woman who actually works part-time in our office 15 hours a week, and she does have a PCA. And what it helps her with is she gets kind of overwhelmed. If the dishes pile up, you know, if the newspapers pile up, she just gets overwhelmed by it, and her anxiety acts up, and then she just gets overwhelmed and gets depressed and then doesn't want to do anything. And what her PCA is able to do is to actually say, okay, come on, let's just tackle this just a little bit at a time and kind of help her through that barrier. She has lost her housing a couple of times because of the stacked papers and things like that when she didn't have a PCA. So we just want to make sure that those kind of in-home supports that people need, not for a lot of hours a day, you know, maybe just a few hours a week, that actually helps them stay in their home in a much less expensive setting. So we just also urge your support.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. Members, any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'm just a little bit confused. I think Ms. Abderholden started to get to this, but the people who are eligible for this program, am I wrong thinking that these people are eligible because they would otherwise be in need of institutional care, kind of like our waiver programs, right? Is that the same population that we're talking about here?
Ms. Henry.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, no, this certainly some of the people that use this program are eligible for an institutional level of care, but you have to qualify through criteria of needing either hands-on assistance, so that means you have physical disabilities, or it used to be that you needed prompting and cueing to accomplish the basic tasks, but in 2009, constant was added, and that was done in order to cut off a number of people to save money in the budget crisis of that era. So you are not required to meet the institutional level of care, though many people do. And one of the problems that's come, as Ms. Abderholden said, we have the new nursing facility level of care, and even there, a lot of people who have memory problems and behavioral issues and other kinds of confusion, such as maybe with dementia or with someone with a mental illness, they qualify for a nursing home, but they don't qualify for this program. So we no longer have a good match, really, with this, because this is such a lesser service. And if we can support people with this in the community, we ought to.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
That's a great explanation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That was very helpful. Thank you. Any other questions, members? Okay, seeing none. Representative Backer will renew his motion that House File 1073 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam.
And Representative Backer, you also have House File 1853. And so Representative Backer will move that House File 1853 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And I understand there is an author's amendment, Representative Backer.
Yes, if we could, Madam Chair, members, if we could first accept the amendment and present the bill as with that amendment, I would appreciate that.
Okay, members, so Representative Backer moves his A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Backer, two-year bill as amended.
HF 1853 provides new payments for critical access hospitals and disproportionate shared hospital payments. Section 1 focuses on critical access hospitals. 79 of Minnesota's 133 acute hospitals are critical access hospitals. Just in my district alone, I have six of them. That's 13% of the 79 hospitals in my districts are acute care. And if we did not have them, as an EMT, I would not be able to bring them when someone dials 911 or, of course, non-911 emergencies, too. These hospitals are limited to 25 inpatient beds and must maintain their emergency rooms, which I've been to several emergency rooms in the last 20 years. Critical access hospitals allows hospitals to be reimbursed by Medicaid for the actual cost of providing care. This bill will create a medical assistant cost-based reimbursement for critical access hospitals similar to Medicare. It also will provide supplemental funding to ensure that reimbursement rates for critical access hospitals do not fall well below those other hospitals. This funding, $5.2 million, was included also as part of the governor's budget recommendation. Section 2 focuses on disproportionate share payments. Federal law requires the state Medicaid programs make disproportionate share hospital payments, DSH payments, to qualify hospitals that serve a large number of Medicaid, and uninsured individuals. The federal government has begun enforcing hospital-specific DSH limits, which means that a hospital is not able to be paid in excess of the amount necessary to cover the uncompensated costs. The bill changes the DSH distribution to ensure that the state has a mechanism to distribute federal DSH payments available to the state in the event that any hospitals hit their hospital-specific limit. And with that, Madam Chair and members, I will set my testifier.
Welcome to the committee.
Members of the committee, I'm Kristen Longcourage with the Hospital Association. I'm happy to just answer some questions because I think Representative Backer did a great job explaining the bill. I just wanted to point out we had passed out to all of you the map of all the critical access hospitals around the state. So if you take a look, you can see, you know, from Laverne up to Halleck, over to Grand Marais, and down to Wabasha, you'll see their critical access hospitals just all over the state. So just one more statistic that I wanted to point out to you. When the Department of Human Services was looking at the critical access hospital payments, they realized that our critical access hospital fee-for-service inpatient was paid at about 55% of their payments came from Medicare. That's the federal program for those folks that are 65 and older. So 55% from Medicare and about 15% from Medicaid. So for these critical access hospitals, 70% of their payments are coming from a government payer. So they really have a very limited ability to cost shift. And so that's why we're so pleased that this legislation is before you, to really give the department some more flexibility in how they're paying these critical access hospitals.
I'll just briefly see if there anyone else in the audience wants to testify to the bill. Okay, seeing none, we'll go to member questions. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And looking at the provided map, I'm noticing that if you go down 35, that the two bottom counties from 35 all the way to the Wisconsin border, none of those eight appear to have a critical care hospital. And I'm thinking that that's about, I don't know, a 16th of the, there's a fair amount of population there. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to understand why those eight, there's nothing there in those eight counties.
Ms. Longridge.
Madam Chair and Representative Plum, those hospitals would be larger than 25 beds, wouldn't meet the federal criteria. I mean, there could be a variety of reasons, but they do have to be fewer than, 25 beds or fewer.
Okay. Other questions, members? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page
page 3, line 3.35, do you have any idea about the difference for these hospitals between their ratio of their costs and their charges for the in the MA program?
Ms. Longridge.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, could you, I'm not sure I'm understanding your question.
So do you...
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have any idea of the discrepancy or the difference on average between those two, the charge versus the cost for treating MA patients?
Ms. Longridge.
Madam Chair and Representative Schultz, I think that that might be a technical question that the Department of Human Services could answer.
Is there anyone from the department who wants to take a crack at that? Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Julie Marquardt. I'm the Purchasing and Service Delivery Director at the Department of Human Services. And the list of items that is out there are things that we would consider. And we haven't done an analysis of the ratio of their charges to their costs. But what we are looking at are a set of factors that we wouldn't want to pay up to cost if we have a hospital who is quite out of alignment there. So this just gives us a set of markers to look at, comparing quite efficient hospitals with maybe hospitals who have higher costs. But we don't have that analysis yet. That's something we would undertake.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Seeing none, Representative Backer will renew his motion that House File 1853, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Members, next we have Representative Zerwas. With House File 1582. And Representative Zerwas will move that House File 1582 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. There is an author's amendment titled the A1.
Madam Chair, I'll move the bill, then I'll move the author's amendment.
Okay, Representative moves the A1 amendment to get the order that he would like the bill discussed in. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Madam Chair, members, the A1 author's amendment is a result of a lot of work between some of the interested parties, including the department. And so I want to thank everyone's help for their negotiations and compromise. House File 1582 adds clarity to provisions of the current law dealing with the licensure of body art technicians in Minnesota. Now, I'm going to be honest, this is a new topic for me. Not in my wheelhouse. So this is a...
We're
out of the limb here. Let's just go with it. Body art technicians include tattoo artists and body piercers. The legislation was brought to me by an establishment that provides body piercing. Almost Famous was concerned that the current licensing laws lacked clarity in some areas and some clarity in enforcement. They worked closely with the Department of Health to address concerns that MDH had with the previous legislation that led to the A1 amendment that we just adopted, and that was the last of those concerns. At this time, I think we have two testifiers that can kind of walk through what the agreement was and answer any questions. And so, Madam Chair, members, at this time I'll turn it over to the testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carol Tepley. I'm the president of Almost Famous Body Piercing, a body piercing establishment with 3 locations in Minnesota, including Mall of America. Over the past 12 months, the technicians at those 3 locations have performed over 20,000 piercings. We brought this bill to Representative Zerwas to seek greater clarification to the existing laws that regulate our practice. As a business, we are seeking that clarification to add certainty to the regulations that will be applied to us. We have sought technical advice from the Minnesota Department of Health and have worked to address their concerns with the bill. The body art licensing law is relatively new, being enacted in 2010. It regulates body piercing technicians and tattoo artists in the state of Minnesota. House File 1582 primarily does four different things. One, it clarifies and strengthens requirements for body artist licensure. Two, it clarifies the identification requirements for a minor to receive a body piercing. Three, it prohibits certain piercings. And four, it requires a renewal notification to licensees. Most of the changes are clarifying as they are consistent with current law and regulatory practices, but two changes are a bit more substantial. The first of those two more substantial changes can be found at Section 2 beginning at line 1.20. This provision lists body piercing types that would be prohibited. These piercings would be prohibited because they are rare and could pose a serious health risk to the person being pierced. This list was provided to us when the Department of Health was providing technical assistance to us. The second more substantial change is found in Section 6, beginning at line 3.9 of the bill. This leaves the standards for tattoo artists the same as current law, but changes the licensure requirements for body piercing technicians from 200 hours of experience to 250 piercings under direct supervision and 250 piercings under indirect supervision. This change increases the licensure requirements as the Department of Health is currently interpreting 200 hours of experience to be the same as 250 piercings. Requiring a set number of piercings is more appropriate than the hours requirement for piercing, as it is a more objective measure of experience, and I feel that the 500 total piercings is appropriate to ensure that piercers are properly trained. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for being here. And did you also want to testify?
Yes.
If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, my name is Amanda Moss. I'm originally from Waukton, North Dakota. I'm a graduate of Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, and I'm currently a body piercer for and general manager of Awful Sandwich Body Piercing. And I'm here to help answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here. Anyone else in the audience wants to testify to the bill? Okay. Questions from members. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is Princess Albertina piercing?
Ms. Tepley.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, it's a female genital piercing. Would you like more information?
No. Now we know.
Madam Chair and members, there's a reason why we pushed this late into the evening.
I wanted to throw us.
Not gonna happen.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Zerwas. I'm really disappointed in your amendment, because I liked Section 1, and I wanted to ask you to talk about the body piercing of the male and female genitalia. And even though we now heard that there's one kind that's going to be prohibited, apparently there are a lot of them that aren't prohibited, and can you give us a little primer on that?
Definitely, Madam Chair.
Apparently, we need to start putting ratings on our committee hearings so people are properly prepared for what we're going to be talking about. Representative Zerwas.
Just glad I could help, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, you know, Representative Liebling, I don't believe I would be the appropriate person to provide more detail on that. 10 open heart surgeries later, the thought of any type of piercing, and I would about hit the floor. So, crack my chest, just don't pierce my anything. So, with that, if you want to know about some of the piercing that would still be allowed. I'm sure one of the testifiers could go into great detail.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair, I really would like to know because, and I have a particular reason for asking, but I won't tell you what it is.
Oh, my God.
Well, earlier in the day, we were talking about inspecting. Let's try it.
Something could be said.
But Representative Zerwas, I'm disappointed that you're carrying this bill and that you can't explain it. I am really disappointed in you.
Madam
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair.
Anyone who says we can't have fun in this committee is clearly confused. Oh. Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair and members, I know that there were there are two changes specifically into some piercings that are no longer going to be allowed under current law. Many piercings that I wouldn't think of in a million years are still going to be allowed to under law. And at this time, I'll turn it over to someone who can walk through some of the piercings that will, God knows why someone wants them, but would still be allowed under this provision.
Ms. Tepley.
So I'm not quite sure what question I'm supposed to ask. I apologize. I got lost.
We can provide some clarity. Representative Liebling.
Let me try again. So on a serious note. So I was surprised when I read the original bill. I guess I should have thought about it, maybe. But a lot of us don't give a lot of thought to this because, like Representative Zerwas, you know, we would probably find ourselves in the bottom of a lake before we'd find ourselves getting a piercing. But the idea that people are getting genital piercing gives me great pause. And I guess the reason seriously, folks, this was a few years ago we licensed this profession for the very first time, you know, and licensing, as you all know, is controversial. And the main issue about licensing and the reason that we license under Chapter 214 is because of public safety. And I'm so glad this profession is licensed. I think it's great. I think we've made some improvements. There are a lot of issues about infection and stuff that are a lot better, and I'm sure you ladies would agree that a lot of the probably bad actors are sort of getting weeded out of the profession, and that was part of the reason to go through with this. But really, seriously, a lot of our health-related licensing professions, we require people to get background studies, right? We do a lot of background studies on, you know, we do criminal background checks on people before we give them a license, because they are in contact with vulnerable people. And the idea that piercers are doing genital piercing makes me wonder, could a person be a predatory sex offender and still be licensed to be able to do genital piercing? That's really what I'm concerned about. Kind of not that funny at all, really.
No.
Ms. Tepley.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, I can't address specifically the changes that we made don't address that portion of the licensing. But I know at our Mall of America location in Bloomington, there are still either cities or counties that have their own laws governing licensing. So when we have a person in Bloomington, Minnesota, who would like to become licensed, they need to go through one extra step with the city of Bloomington themselves, and that's at the point where they go through a background check. Not every place does it the same way, and because we're at the very beginnings of this licensing process, I believe that as we move forward, things will change and get stronger. And I'd just like to share briefly my experience of coming into the industry. I always get the comment, you know, what do you do for a living? And I say I'm a body piercer, and it takes people back because why would I do that and I don't look like one? But about 20 years ago, I worked as a buyer for a retail store, and we decided to sell a selection of body jewelry. And we'd been selling jewelry for several months, and I was working one day, and a young girl came in. We served a large cross-section, lots of ages, and she was in her younger teens, and she came in and she was looking for jewelry for her tongue piercing. And she said, I'm not sure what size to get. And I said, well, usually it's this, but can I see, you know, what you have in there right now? And she opened her mouth, and I looked in her mouth, and there wasn't any jewelry in there, but there was this black mark on her tongue. And I said, well, I don't see your jewelry. And she said, well, I just got it pierced last night. My mom and her boyfriend pierced it with a sharpened implement, and I have a toothpick in my piercing to hold it open until I can buy some jewelry and put some jewelry in there. And as a mom myself at the time, when I saw that, and I understand that not a lot of people either agree wholeheartedly, a lot of people will disagree with certain folks' lifestyle choices. At the time, piercing was not a widely available service, so people were doing it to themselves. That was the choice that they had. So I really encouraged this young lady to go see a medical professional because there could have been several things that had happened during that piercing. She left the store that day, and I don't know what happened to her. And that kind of stuck in my mind, and that's how the idea of Almost Famous Body Piercing came to be. Because if I could bring this service safely to a larger section of the community, people who would not go into a tattoo shop, maybe because they're afraid or that's just not their lifestyle, this is becoming a very mainstream service. It's considered more of a beauty service than it is a modification service for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And you see them everywhere. You go to Target and check out or the grocery store, you see piercings on people everywhere.
Yeah. Representative Leapley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that. That's really interesting to hear that story. And just to be clear, I mean, I support people's choice to decorate their bodies any way they want to. And I'm very glad we have licensing because I also think that the state has a responsibility to make sure that it's as safe as it's reasonably safe and that people know what they're getting into and stuff like that. So, you know, we're good with that. And most of the changes in this I'm fine with. But seeing it broken out the way it was in the original bill, I actually think it would be good to have different levels. I don't know what all the discussions were that made us back off of that, Representative Zerwas, but I am concerned when I look at this that included in this is complex body piercing, which means body piercing that is branding, scarification, suspension. Oh, let's see, I'm sorry, I'm looking, actually, the middle one, advanced, which is body piercing the male and female genitalia. And the idea that people are doing that, they're licensed, they're doing that, and they're not required to have a background check. And believe me, I think that I'm not one of the people who thinks that anybody who's ever done anything wrong shouldn't be able to work, and there are such people. But I am a little concerned if we're doing genital piercing that we are not requiring a background check as a state for people who would be doing that. Because if you've got somebody in a room and you're going to pierce their genitalia, that's a pretty intimate situation with somebody. And, you know, I don't know. But just to throw that out there, Representative Zerwas, that's what I thought of when I read your bill. But as to what's in there today, I'm fine with it. Thank you.
And Representative Leibley, I do think you raised a good point, and not that I want to go down this road real far, but I'm just thinking about, and I don't know the answer to this, when we look at aestheticians, folks that do waxing on folks and, you know, some very intimate ways sometimes. I don't know, do we require background checks? Do you know?
Are they even licensed? I don't know.
Something to look into. I believe they are, but just, and so it gets into that same thing of kind of a similar type issue. So, okay. So we can get back. Representative Zarasa, do you have any thoughts to that? And then we have other questions.
Madam Chair and members, I think it's certainly a topic to look into. I know that this is certainly the midpoint of discussion between the stakeholders and the Department of Health. And negotiations continue. And I'm just really glad I was able to bring this bill today.
Us too, Representative Zerwas. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members. I represent the Arts District Northeast, and we have 700 artists, some of whom do tattoo art, but now when I see the piercing signs, I'll have different visions in my head. but my question is, on the changes that you made on Section 6 by the amendment, you took away, as I understand it, basically the requirements for advanced, let's just say, advanced piercing art forms, being that you had to at least have supervised experience by someone who's a pro at this. And so I think, and I'm just, that the only requirement now for supervised experience is 250 body piercings under direct supervision and 250 body piercings under indirect supervision, which could be ear piercings. And I guess I don't want someone who's been mostly doing, let's just say, the easiest, least risky things suddenly going to these much more risky sort of things without having had any training or supervision. And so could you explain why you took away or why the advocates for this have taken away the supervised training on these what seem to me very risky and invasive procedures?
Ms. Templey.
Madam Chair, Representative. When we discussed the tiered licensing, we talked about some of the things that could or should be in each tier. We didn't feel that there was time to really fully discuss or bring in enough people to have a full discussion on the tiering. But being that it's 200 hours currently required for a body piercer, it's just hours. So there was discussion as to whether that's hours doing what. So in speaking to the Department of Health, when they made the change to 250 actual piercings, that was really good news to us, because what that meant was that now we have proof that it's not just 200 hours clocking in and clocking out, it's part of an actual practice. And with body piercing, as like some other skilled jobs, it's on-the-job training. So we do have some study that we do. We talk about anatomy. We do some health training. And then we work a lot with the tools. And before they pierce anyone, they need to have some practice, and we use silicone models. We teach them how to use the tools appropriately. And then we go to piercings on very simple, anatomically correct silicone models. And then we move into piercing real people. So the people that we train do get, you know, more training than just jumping in and, hey, here's a needle, go pierce that person. We also have multiple piercers at each site. So if some of those at each site, so if some of the less common piercings come in and someone has a question, there's somebody else there that will go in the room with them that has that experience.
Representative Loeffler. Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair and members, and that's, I think, one thing we want to make sure that is understood right now, is right now it's 200 hours. Mm-hmm. You clock 200 hours in a tattoo shop, and in a piercing shop, and you've logged the requisite experience. And so what this is changing is it's saying you need to do 250 piercings under direct supervision, and then before you can be licensed, you need to do another 250 with, you know, the phone-a-friend option or a indirect supervision. And then so this is much more comprehensive, skill-intensive, and actual product-intensive process than saying, you know, you need to work 5 40-hour weeks.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand that this is better than what, in some ways, are more accountable than what we have. But my concern is that they still, for these more invasive, perhaps permanently scarring things that could go awry in places that you wouldn't want things to go awry in, that there maybe needs to be a portfolio or a willingness to disclose their experience level to the customer, because if someone desires to have one of these interesting art piercings, I would think that you would want to know if you're the first one post-silicone, or if you're the 200th post the model, in having confidence on the person who's going to work with you.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Loeffler, being a full-time, lifetime patient, you never want to know when you're the first. It's terrifying. In all honesty, and jokes aside, I think what the A1 Amendment represents, just so we're clear, is a large working group of practitioners, experts within the field, and the Department of Health saying this is the appropriate amount of time and training and supervision. I personally don't think there'd ever be an appropriate amount of time and training and experience for them to do it on me. That being said, all of the experts in the field that have been involved with this process and the Department of Health have come to agreement that this is it. This is the agreement. And that this is the appropriate level of experience and practice, and considerably better than having someone log hours for the sake of logging hours.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Zerwas, since you have bravely volunteered to become our expert on this topic, I would like you to, and the industry, to consider a continuing ed requirement, because almost every other health profession does it. And what I'm concerned about is that to get initially licensed, you have to have 5 hours of coursework on bloodborne pathogens, prevention of disease transmission, infection control, aseptic technique. And as we know, we have new superbugs that have invaded our hospitals, that even our best infection control experts are having a hard time dealing with. And it seems to me that keeping people in this profession up to date on what are the new superbugs, how to identify them, how to know when you've got an issue in a patient who might come to you that you would recognize some signs or symptoms. I mean, I just feel like you might want to consider in your second bill on this and your continuing discussion with the industry to look at a continuing ad that just says every year. And I'm sure the health department and others would be glad to put together a videotaped version. I mean, it could even be online. It doesn't have to be, you know, a big deal. But I just really feel like for all of us who could be a patient in any medical setting, the risk of getting some of these that are antibiotic resistant are very difficult to deal with is a real risk to all of us and to the people who are doing this, performing this work. So I would encourage you to continue the discussions on that.
Representative Zerwas. Or Ms. Temple.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, we do more training than what's stated in the law right now. We actually have 40 hours of training that somebody does before we start them. We do CPR, first aid. We have continuing ed where we spend a day with each person and we train for a full day. Training is ongoing. So when you think of the 250 piercings that are supervised, they're not just supervising just the piercing service. They're supervising the entire time in the room. So they get all of the cleaning, using the autoclave, making sure that the tools are appropriately cycled through that cycle to get them autoclaved and sterilized again if they're reusable, making sure that each technician is aware what is biohazard waste and what is not. So we do work with them quite extensively. We also do checkbacks with them where we'll come in after they have gotten their permanent license and we'll observe them. We'll watch them do some piercings, and that's, we don't usually tell them when we're going to be stopping by to watch. So we see whatever piercings come in, and that's also part of our business practice.
Madam Chair,
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Ms. Dibley. Are you referring to your business and the business you're associated with, or every single practitioner in the state has that system?
Ms. Dibley.
That is specific to us.
And Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's my concern, is that we have lots of people who are hanging out shingles, and they may have started with your business, or they may have trained in California or somewhere else, and our job is to make sure that every business has the best practice, not based on the particulars of any one. And so I was trying to be clear if it was an association that self-monitors, but it sounds like it's your individual business. Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I get into my question, just to Representative Loeffler, it doesn't matter what profession. As a teenager, I went into the ER for some stitches after utilization of a motorcycle, and the one doctor said to the next doctor, this would be a good opportunity for you to practice your left-hand stitching.
Wow.
it didn't faze me. My mother was a little perturbed. So, but again, it doesn't matter where you are. At some point, if somebody's being trained, someone's going to be model number one. Now, now on to my question. With the advent of 400 or 500 TV stations and reality programming, etc., actually, I think it was on the Sci-Fi Channel, there were examples. You see cosplay, sci-fi fantasy, naturalists. So you've got people that are modifying their bodies to look like an animal, adding Romulan or Vulcaneers, Klingon ribs on your forehead and skull. What I'm curious about is, at what point do you transition from this profession into cosmetic surgery? Because, honestly, if you have implants and you go far enough, you could do quite a bit. And so I'm just trying to understand where that transition would be.
Ms. Templey.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do basic body piercings for the most part at Almost Famous Body Piercing. We don't go into scarification. We don't do any tattoos. We do microdermal piercings at two of our locations in Minnesota. And like what you're talking about, those types of things we do not do.
Can I just ask, what's microdermal piercing?
Sorry?
Microdermal piercing, what is that exactly?
Yep, it's...
Ms. Templey?
It's a single point piercing, and part of the jewelry is underneath the skin, and then there's a small top that's on the top. Yep. They're not permanent, they are removable.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. And I guess there are a plethora of possible questions, and since I don't think anyone here is expert enough to know the breadth and depth of this topic, what committee does this go to next? I apologize.
Representative Quam, it's going to HHS Finance. Representative Quam.
Thank you. I will eagerly await the scheduling and hope that House video televises.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this will be fairly quick, but I'm glad we're here talking about this, and it sounds like your practices are really top-notch, and kind of falling back to Representative Loeffler's question about just best practices, are your facilities inspected by the state to make sure that they're approved and that they're in good condition, and is that for the industry if you, and again, hang a sign out and say body piercings? How is that when it comes to the actual facility?
Ms. Templey.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we are inspected. As I explained previously with the Bloomington location, we do have some locations that are exempted from state location licensing, and then we go into the local jurisdiction. So we're licensed in the city of Minneapolis for our location, but our technicians are still licensed through the state of Minnesota. In Bloomington, Minnesota, we have a technician registration, I believe is what they call it, not a license. And then they also license our location, but we're still required to have the technicians licensed through the state. So there are some differences. Yes, we are inspected.
Thank you.
And members, we do have Ms. Finnegan. Here, someone from the department who can speak to the background check issue. Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself, maybe shed a little bit of light on the background check issue.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Erin Smilinich, and I am the body art inspector, licensor, and investigator, and enforcement person for the state. You're the only one. To your question about the background checks, we do actually have a process. So when you apply for licensure through the state, you have to check a box that says if you have been convicted of a sexual criminal conduct felony conviction. And if you have been, we do run a special background check, and we can deny your license based on that. And we do special background checks. They're just basic. We don't have the ability to do federal background checks right now.
Yeah. Representative Liebling, any follow-up questions to that?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm glad to hear that. Do you do the same? Is it the same whether the person is going to do just the basic kind of body piercing, or if they're going to? I mean, you wouldn't know when they apply whether they intend to do genital piercing or just other kinds of basic piercing, right? So everybody's getting treated the same?
Madam Chair and Representative, correct. Anytime you apply for a body art license, everyone is treated the same.
Okay.
Representative Lee. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much for your help on that. Appreciate it. Members, any other questions?
Oh, Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Madam Chair. Oh, don't leave. Yeah, I think a lot of us on the committee want to know if you're the only one of who's doing the job that you described. I hope you're not the only one.
Well, that depends on what job. So, Madam Chair and Representatives, for inspections, I inspect the state minus Hennepin Steel and Anoka counties. And then licensing, I license all of the establishments in the state except for Hennepin, Steele, and Anoka counties. And I was doing all of the technician licensure, but I am passing that off and training someone else in.
Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, what I really wanted to ask, that was actually other people's question, but but I really wanted to ask, because going back to Representative Loeffler's question about ongoing training of some, I thought we had some kind of ongoing training, and you're nodding, so would you just sort of explain what we require as updates, and because I know we're pretty stringent about this infection control piece, right?
Madam Chair and Representative, yes. When you do apply for your initial licensure, you have to have a bloodborne pathogen, aseptic technique, infection control, and
well, now I'm blanking on the last one, but you have to have a certificate in all these trainings. And then when you go to renew your license, you also have to renew that certificate. So you do have to have a continuing education certificate. And I believe in the amendment that we're trying to pass, we're trying to up that to 5 hours, because currently the statute is pretty slim in that, and you can do just an online training, which is pretty poor. And if we can up it to 5, that would be even better.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, members. I'm sorry. Representative Zerwas.
No, I just had to say, Mr. Goodnow, I asked him a few months ago, what are you working on? And he mentioned this, and I thought, I really want to work on this. And I just want to thank everyone, because this hearing was as memorable as I thought it would be. Hot dog! For that, Madam Chair, I will renew my motion to refer House File 1582 as amended to HHS Finance.
Okay. Members, Representative DeRoss renews his motion that House File 1582 as amended be re-referred to HHS Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative DeRoss. Members, that is it for our agenda today. Our next meeting will be Friday at 10 a.m. in room 10. With that, members, we are adjourned.